Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Support for the Exchange Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Josh Rogers. And this is The Exchange. The New Hampshire House Budget Committee was busy this week crafting a proposed spending plan for the state which would cut $18 million in funding from kindergarten, much to the dismay of full-day kindergarten advocates. Meanwhile, Governor Sununu visited our Canadian neighbors with a quick trip to Montreal, where he promoted bringing hydroelectric power from Quebec to New England via the Northern Pass Project. Sununu also called for updating rather than eliminating the North American Free Trade Agreement. Finally, in sad news, State Senator Scott McGillivray, former president of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Education Association, passed away this week at age 51. Many state leaders called McGillivray a strong advocate for children in New Hampshire. Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And I have two great reporters joining me in studio for the weekly news roundup this morning. Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader. And Kevin, it's good to see you.
Thanks, Dean. Great to be back.
And Casey McDermott, digital reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Casey, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, Governor Sununu made a fair bit of news this week, and let's start with his trip to Montreal to meet with Quebec's Premier Philippe Couillard. The trip caught the media a bit by surprise. Casey, what happened?
So I, I believe it was Monday, was on my way into the office, I think walking into work, and saw an email come through from the governor's press office letting us know that he was going to be in Montreal starting at about noon. I think he had a press conference or a lunch that he was doing and then had a number of other kind of events on deck for the rest of the day. This, I think it's fair to say, like you said, this caught the press a little bit off guard because, you know, the governor is making a trip out of the country. Typically, I think we would expect maybe a little bit more advance notice rather than 3 hours before he's set to have his first event up there. So I know that was a little bit, I would say probably unusual for us not to receive more advance notice on that. Nonetheless, the governor was there to do, I think they characterized it as kind of like a business development trip, you know, part of his effort to attract more businesses to New Hampshire. He spoke at a luncheon. He had a joint press conference with some local leaders up there. And talked just broadly about a number of different kind of economic issues ranging from Northern Pass to trade agreements to just other kind of issues that would, you know, tie together the Canadian and New Hampshire regions.
And Kevin, would the media typically accompany the governor, or what would be the sort of the standard process for this kind of trip up into Canada?
It really depends, you know, Dean, on the subject matter and the politics of the day, whether reporters from New Hampshire would make that trip. They certainly have in the past. I've made that trip before, not only to Montreal, but to the Eastern Premier's meetings where all the New England governors meet with the Eastern Canadian Premier's. And given that this was his first trip, there may well have been some reporters who'd been there. I don't think it was a case of the governor trying to secretly get out of the country and meet with folks over the border. And someone got wind of it, and therefore he put out an advisory to the media. I think it's really about how this governor has conducted himself when it comes to attracting business outside the state. He's gone outside the state routinely since he's become governor, visited with companies outside the state, and the reporters have not known that has occurred, haven't gotten a list of where he's gone and what companies he's met with, because he feels very strongly that to do that would obviously compromise his ability to try and attract jobs. These businesses don't want to know the out-of-state governors coming there to try and take jobs.
Right, right.
So, and the same would be true about businesses right over the Canadian border.
And Casey, do you think that this matters? Was there an outcry from the public, or is this sort of insider baseball?
You know, I think whenever you get into these situations with, you know, the media maybe kind of quote unquote griping about access or things like that, I think we have to be very careful about making clear that this is not a matter of, at least from my perspective, this isn't a matter of, you know, journalists just whining because we didn't get to go to Canada with the governor. He is the state's top public official. He's its chief executive. In my opinion, there's a certain kind of obligation to, you know, let the public know what you're doing, what you're up to, particularly when it's a matter of public interest. This is, you know, obviously the governor has made attracting businesses, building ties between, you know, perhaps Canadian businesses and New Hampshire businesses or out-of-state businesses and New Hampshire businesses a priority. And part of our job as reporters is to let the public know what their public officials are doing. And in order to do that, there is a certain level of kind of communication that is required or expected, I think, on the part of the governor's office.
And Kevin, did we learn anything new about the governor's position on Northern Pass or on – he also mentioned the North American Free Trade Agreement, which President Trump has talked about ripping up. This was the treaty negotiated by Bill Clinton several decades ago.
In a word, not really. Much of what the governor had to say on both topics were pretty consistent with what he has said in the past. He's been a supporter of NAFTA in the past. Despite Trump's opposition to it, he acknowledged that there could be some updating of that treaty for technology.
Yeah, he wasn't very specific.
He wasn't
about
specific
what to
about
do with it.
Right, and I think as a as a pro-business governor, I think he, like a lot of Republican governors all over the country, are struggling with trying to mesh their positions on economic issues with Trump's positions on those issues. I thought, frankly, his comments on Northern Pass, whilst consistent, were more timely and more important, frankly, as we've seen in HPR's reported, that the Quebec government and many business leaders up there have become very anxious about Northern Pass and whether New Hampshire is really committed to Northern Pass and whether New Hampshire is going to require even more transmission lines to be buried in order to approve Northern Pass. So,
but now Sununu has said, though, that it's not viable to bury the project completely. Is that correct, Casey?
Yeah. I mean, if we're thinking back to the gubernatorial campaign, he was, I think, clearly the most pro-Northern Pass in its current form. Candidate on either side of the aisle. He did not, you know, kind of separate himself in the way that some of his Republican opponents and Democratic opponents did in terms of demanding more of the line being buried or outright opposing the project in general.
Yeah, and we had gone through kind of a long period of time with Governor Hassan where he was kind of opposed, kind of not sure.
He's been pretty clearly pro-Northern Pass as far as I can remember,
Yeah, and one of the things about obviously the notice traveling out of the country without a lot of notice is particularly politically tone deaf, because after all, he's the first Republican elected in 12 years as governor, and he follows a governor, a Democratic governor, who was pilloried by the state Republican Party, and sometimes rightfully so, frankly, for traveling out of the state repeatedly during a campaign for the U.S. Senate last year.
So I'm sure there will be other trips to Canada for in Governor Sununu's future. But he also made news this week, and we'll discuss whether or not this is a real news story or just kind of the media and the political observers. Casey, let me turn to you. The issue of the skiing selfie at Waterville Valley. What happened here?
Yeah, I think I'm actually kind of interested in this question of whether this is the first time that a tweet has prompted an ethics
complaint. We're in a new world now, given our president's
penchant for tweeting. No, but I think it's a legitimately interesting question, just given the realities of kind of campaigning and politicking and governing.
And I will
say
he's more active on Twitter than I've seen from from other, you know, well, certainly than Governor Hassan. And before that, you know, Governor Lynch, Twitter really wasn't a factor. But I see him pop up a lot on social media.
Yeah.
And it's actually him a lot of the time doing it.
Yeah, he and he has. So I will start this by saying that there are two Kristen Nunus on Twitter. And I think this is kind of a key thing to keep in mind as this story develops. There is Chris Sununu, which is the account that he maintained. My understanding is that it's been in place for years. It was kind of a quasi-personal account before it turned into a campaign account. And then there is this Governor Chris Sununu Twitter account that is his official, it says, you know, official governor of New Hampshire. And that was born after he was inaugurated as governor. So last weekend, excuse me, I believe was when this photo was tweeted. He was out enjoying a day on the slopes at Waterville Valley, which is the ski resort that up until December 31st, he was the CEO of. It's a ski resort that his family bought about 7 years ago in 2010. His family still holds a I was told at the end of last year when he was stepping aside, his family still holds a majority of the seats on the board there, though we don't have any information on which members of the Sununu family are there or what the extent of their financial stake is in the country or the company. So anyway, the governor tweets a photo of himself on the slopes at Waterville Valley, him a selfie with his son. Says, you know, best ski day. Great to be back at Waterville, enjoying the best snow NH has to offer. Everyone should be in the White Mountains this weekend. And that was from his official account.
Mm-hmm.
And the New Hampshire Democrats are saying that partially because it was on his official gubernatorial account, that in their view, raises questions of whether he is improperly using his position as governor to benefit his family's resort.
And Kevin, you know, we're hearing a lot about these kinds of issues, obviously, with the Trump presidency and all the financial entanglements. You've been around here a long time doing this. Have these kinds of issues arisen in New Hampshire in other contexts, or is this really a new thing because of Twitter?
Sure. I think they have arisen in the
past. Sort of a conflict of interest.
Certainly business interests that past governors and past legislative leaders have had. And certainly using the official account probably was not a good idea for this governor to do. It's important to point out, like you said, he's pretty ubiquitous on Twitter. And even using the official account, he has mentioned Gunstock Ski Area, a real competitor of Waterville Valley, I might add, a couple of times on the official account before this tweet. He needs to be very careful to try and not have it appear as if he's giving Waterville Valley an edge over any other ski area in the state. And I think to this point he had been, and throughout the campaign, frankly, he had been doing a pretty good job of that right up until this tweet. It's something people certainly need to keep an eye on. I think what would be more disturbing, more alarming, more potentially unethical, frankly, would be to see Waterville Valley try and use this governor mm-hmm. to promote the mountain. And we haven't seen any evidence of that at all.
Mm-hmm. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, and I'll get your email in the studio. I'm joined by two reporters today, Kevin Landrigan from the Union Leader and Casey McDermott from right here at NHPR. To either of you, how does this get resolved?
So there is a complaint that the Democratic Party has filed with the Executive Branch Ethics Committee. As of yesterday afternoon, I have not checked back today, but the committee had not actually had that complaint in its possession. But my understanding is that it is en route there. And the committee meets on a monthly basis when there are complaints to review. I believe their next meeting would be the first week of April, the first Wednesday of April. There, as I was explained yesterday, their deliberations on complaints are confidential. So we actually won't see this unless it goes to a hearing, or we won't see the kind of like internal
right.
discussion that may be taking place as far as them weighing whether or not this is legit.
And what can they do, though? Do you find them? Is it a slap on the wrist, or you get something in your file? And anybody know, Kevin?
Well, certainly they have the authority to issue opinions, but we've yet to see this Executive Branch Ethics Committee since it's been created. actually ordered a significant sanction against an executive branch member. And as Casey pointed out, even more than the Legislative Ethics Committee, frankly, this Executive Branch Ethics Committee, and through its creation, is pretty much a star chamber. And so much of, we know almost next to nothing about all the complaints that have been filed over the years, mainly the number of complaints and how many have actually gone to a filing. And
Can see, if you're interested, as I was yesterday, you can see some of the complaints that they have weighed in on, or the opinions, which I believe is different than the complaints. So people, this body both responds to complaints like the one that the Democratic Party has filed and also issues opinions when questions arise. So, you know, for example, there's questions about can the Lottery Commission award Red Sox game tickets to state liquor store employees at part of the commission's sales incentives program without violating the state's prohibition on gifts. So those kinds of questions, or, you know, can a state employee who's earned frequent flyer mileage as a result of state reimbursed travel use that for his or her personal benefit? So there's a number of questions on the Ethics Committee website that can give you a sense of the kinds of things that they deal with. As far as I can see just scanning this, there's not a lot of stuff that treads the line on this, what we were starting off this conversation talking about with this kind of, you know, quote unquote, new frontier of, you know, digital promotion. What counts as promoting? Does simply mentioning Waterville count as promoting it at the, you know, giving it an advantage that is not conferred on other resorts? So that's something that I'm going to be interested in seeing, how this kind of, you know, this body that was created before we had these new platforms and new ways of communication deals with this kind of a question.
Yeah, technology and social media is constantly forcing everybody to adapt. So we have the Canada trip, the skiing selfie, and a third area where the governor made some news, Kevin, is with executive appointments, and he officially nominated Manchester attorney Gordon MacDonald, partner Nixon Peabody, to be the next attorney general of New Hampshire. What do we know about this?
Well, certainly Gordon MacDonald's a longtime lawyer, very respected lawyer in from Manchester. Excuse me, Republican activist, was very active in presidential campaigns in past, including in 2016, worked for Marco Rubio's campaign as well, and has received a lot of support since his nomination. At the public hearing, I'm sure questions will come up regarding the conflicts of interest he had as an attorney now that he would – if he were to become attorney general. The most prominent is his representation of Purdue Pharma in a lawsuit that the attorney general's office has brought against pharmaceutical companies seeking to get documents to determine whether these pharmaceutical companies inappropriately marketed opioids in order to get people addicted to them. Pharma is the maker of OxyContin. Gordon MacDonald was the lead attorney for Purdue Pharma in this state. So if he becomes attorney general, he'd obviously be on the other side. He has indicated in this case and any others that apply that he would recuse himself, and the deputy attorney general would be the lead person with regard to this matter. The incumbent Joe Foster, who's leaving, by the way, has indicated that's perfectly appropriate. I had many conflicts when I was attorney general, and we worked them out.
Yeah. So, Casey, how has this nomination been received generally?
I think generally it's fair to say that MacDonald has earned pretty broad bipartisan praise people across the aisle. He was involved for several years as the chair of the Campaign for Legal Services. He's earned a lot of praise from people involved in that. Even, you know, executive counselor Andy Valinsky, who has been I think it's fair to say probably Governor Sununu's biggest antagonist on the executive council when it comes to questioning or giving a very thorough vetting, is one way to put it, of his nominees, raised a lot of issues with Education Commissioner Frank Edelblut during his hearing. When asked about this conflict of interest with Gordon MacDonald and the opioid case, said that, you know, he, as long as he recuses himself, he doesn't have any concerns about MacDonald's ability to act ethically in there, which I think is an indication that I would be very surprised if MacDonald is not confirmed at this point.
Well, Kevin, what's so interesting about this Supreme Court case that we're talking about here here with McDonald being a lead, previously being a lead attorney, is, you know, if the issue is allowing to hire outside counsel to deal with millions of pages of documents and discovery, you know, this could in theory end up hurting him as attorney general. Here he was, he was on the one side of the argument initially, and now if they lose the case, he's going to be shorthanded.
That's right. And the lower court, as we know, ruled in favor of the state and essentially said the attorney general has the right to hire outside counsel. It's now on appeal to the state Supreme Court. The state attorney general's office, by the way, feels very confident that the Supreme Court will agree with the lower court and essentially allow them to do this. Gordon McDonald's argument essentially was that the way this outside counsel contingency fee contract would work actually provide an incentive for the company you are hiring to find something out, whether it's ill-gotten or not. If you follow my logic, there's actually a financial incentive for that outside counsel you're hiring to find something worth going after in court, because they get a contingency fee based on the outcome of this case ultimately.
So, Casey, real quick, what's the just for our listeners, what's the process going forward?
So my understanding is that he will get a hearing.
A public hearing,
yep. Just like if, you know, this is probably fresh in a lot of people's minds because of what we saw about a month or two ago with Commissioner Edelblut, get a public hearing, and then the vote will not take place that day. And then at the next, usually I would think at the next executive council meeting after that, there would be a vote, and then if he's confirmed, then he's confirmed, and he will be Attorney General.
He's good to go. Kevin, the other appointment news this week was Frank Edelblut, the head of the Education Department, was now confirmed for a full term. And I'm just curious, real briefly, was there any pushback at all on him for a full term, or was this pretty much just a fait accompli?
Yeah, I think it was. Essentially, there was that controversy last week with regard to him being an anonymous donor to the
Croydon case.
But it was consistent with his beliefs before, and that's why on a party line, the same vote, 3-2, Republicans all for giving him a full four-year term this week.
Casey, your thoughts on Edelblut and just no longer an issue?
I think I would expect – you know, he's in the position now. I would not expect people, you know, who have been his detractors in the past to stop being his detractors. I think that he continues to be a pretty polarizing figure, just in the sense that he, you know, holds very staunch positions on issues of school choice or other education issues.
Exactly.
Yep. And that has, you know, been polarizing to a lot of people, particularly on the Democratic side. I think that the Dems have used him as a kind of foil in the past and will probably continue to do so moving forward, just in a political sense.
What was interesting about this controversy, as we saw with Frank Edelblut, even when he was a candidate for governor, he's very private about his personal life and was throughout the campaign, remained so even after his election. And he kind of pivoted last week again by saying, by actually identifying himself as one of those contributors. I think he understands now he's in a very public position, and sometimes he needs to open that window to himself.
Stay with us. We have to take a short break, but lots more on the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on NHPR.
Diane Leigh Beck's latest novel about a woman lost in the woods explores the nature of love.
People expect it to be this great emotional high. Is love like that, or is it common? And if love is common, you know, what's so great about it?
I'm Peter Biello. The novel Breaking Wild is now out in paperback. Leigh Beck discusses her book on the bookshelf from NHPR. Find this podcast and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis, filling in for Josh Rogers. Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, so let's hear from you. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. I have two reporters with me in studio today. Casey McDermott is a digital reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio, and Kevin Landrigan, who is senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader. And folks, before the break, we were talking about Governor Sununu. Let's move over now and talk about the state legislature. Governor Sununu's budget proposal is under consideration in the House of Representatives. Kevin, the big news, or one of the big headlines coming out of the House budget writers' activity this week was the removal of money, about $18 million for kindergarten.
That's right, Dean. This is the House Finance Subcommittee. It's the first kind of subpanel that actually works on the budget. So we're a long way from this budget becoming law. But it was certainly an early setback for this governor, who made a priority of his full day and his incentive for school districts to offer a full day kindergarten. House Speaker Sean Jasper has been an opponent of the idea. And the House subcommittee, what we're talking about essentially here is what to do with the major surplus that we had from the previous year. And this subcommittee essentially decided, rather than full-day kindergarten offering that, we're going to offer property tax relief to cities and towns. A couple of things to remember. Many conservatives, one, were concerned about how Sununu's full-day kindergarten would work, namely that it would not be offered to all school districts and in equal amounts, but rather be based on the socioeconomics of the school district would determine how much aid you would receive. That rubbed a lot of conservatives the wrong way. Two, you have on this committee in particular, you have a number of senior members who are fully aware that since the last recession began, there's been a lot of downshifting by the state of New Hampshire to cities and towns, whether it's revenue sharing, retirement, public retirement, employee pension payments to cities and towns. So there was a real desire. We've got this big pot of money. Let's just send some of it back to cities and towns and let them decide. If they want to kickstart a full-day kindergarten program with some of that money, great. Go right ahead.
Let's take a listen to Representative Marjorie Smith, a Democrat from Durham, talking about kindergarten and her concerns that it not be linked to other spending in the state budget.
And I am both resentful of and resistant to the argument that if we do provide resources such as kindergarten education, that we will then have to take money from people who are developmentally disabled.
And that is Representative Marjorie Smith, a Democrat from Durham. And Casey, kindergarten seemed to be one of the areas where I know Governor Sununu, when he ran for office, and a number of Democrats in the state Senate and the House talked about a potential for common ground there. But now it seems like this is basically no longer an option.
I don't know if that's
they come back.
Yeah, I mean, just I've not been through many budget cycles here, but my recollection from the last budget cycle and my understanding of how this usually works, it is not at all unusual for the House to get a governor's budget, completely change it, completely, you know, rip it up, start over, put in their own things. And then by the time it gets back to the Senate, it kind of, you know, you're at the middle ground between what the House came up with and the governor came up with. And my understanding is that a lot of that kind of reconciliation is already on its way in terms of the Senate working on their own version of the budget that may or may not include proposals like this full-day kindergarten one.
Yeah, one of the things you need to remember, too, about this budget cycle is it's essentially run by two people who have spent more than 15 years being involved in it. Mm-hmm. You've got on the Senate side, Senate President Chuck Morse, who used to be chairman of the Finance Committee, could basically knows the state budget process backwards and forwards. Neil Kirk, who's the longtime chairman of the House Finance Committee. So, and I suspect both sides are very much aware what the other side really wants. And the House, so Kirk may well be aware that the Senate is willing to support full-day public kindergarten in some form. So I'm going to take my resources, I'm going to take that out and use some of that money to support programs I prefer. And clearly, as we've seen with Speaker Jasper, he'd like to see some property tax relief.
And Casey, there was also, a $5 million scholarship fund suggested by Governor Sununu, and that was put in as $1. But it sounds like a lot of this is still up for discussion.
Yeah, we're very much not finished with the budget right now. Just to, as a refresher, this scholarship program, I believe, was what the governor referred to in his budget address. It would have been $5 million to directly assist high school students to attend colleges and universities or workforce training programs in New Hampshire. So this was seen as a way to kind of get more young people to stay in the state, assist them with the ability to do that. The budget writers in the House did what is a pretty common tactic in terms of saying that, OK, we're not really interested in funding this, but we're going to leave this item in here in case the Senate or whoever gets this next decides to come back to it. And that's what they did with this item and with a number of others. Yeah.
So, Kevin, it sounds like, I mean, we talk about this all the time on the Exchange with the Roundup about how what really matters in the end is what is the final revenue estimates in May and June and the reconciliation or the conference committee right before the budget has to be signed.
Yeah, so sausage making is really what what we're at work here. And this is only the beginning of the recipe. And it is important to point out where you referred to revenue estimates. The House believes it's operating with almost $60 million less in revenue than the governor estimates. So that's one of the reasons why they look at a scholarship program like this and say $5 million additional new money. Like the idea, but we don't think we have that money. Now, we've seen repeatedly when the Senate comes up with its budget, revenue estimates are adjusted, often almost always raised from what the House has proposed in terms of revenue. So I would be shocked if the Senate doesn't determine that. We've got a little more revenue here to play with.
Yeah, it's not over till it's over, and we'll be following the budget as it develops through the House and then into the Senate and then the eventual signing by the governor. And I should mention that Governor Sununu will be a guest on the Exchange next Tuesday, so you can call in and ask him questions directly. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. You can join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us exchange@nhpr.org. Folks, let's turn our attention now to the state Senate. We've talked a bit about the House, but there's a lot of action in the Senate. But I want to begin by noting the passing of State Senator Scott McGillivray at age 51. He was known as a teacher, a coach. He was the head of the state's largest teachers union and a newly elected state senator from the Bow Area. Kevin, your thoughts?
Yeah, a real shock, to be sure, coming so soon after the election.
Yeah, he'd only been in for a few months, right?
He had. A Democrat who won a seat that traditionally has been held by Republicans. Democrats have held that seat before, but since it's been redistricted, he was the first Democrat to win it. It was the only pickup Democrats made last November. But we certainly got an inkling that he was suffering serious health problems when less than a month ago, he announced he was taking a leave of absence as president of the NEA.
But not as a senator. Distinction. Yeah,
correct. And he had indicated even during the campaign when I spoke with him that he suffered from what he called a chronic condition. He didn't elaborate on what that was, but he was fully expecting to be able to do both roles, be the union president and be a state senator. But he leaves behind a whole lot of fans. He was a very revered sports coach and also a very popular head of the NEA, a powerful union that has a lot of influence in New Hampshire.
Yeah, and Casey, we've already heard it mentioned that there may be the executive council decides to have a special election, essentially, correct? Like a primary and then an election if necessary.
Yeah. My understanding and just kind of looking over the reporting that's been done on this so far, I think the union leader noted that it's probably not likely that we're going to see a special election on this until sometime in, you know, late June
summer,
or early July, just given the timing of everything.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, obviously this took a lot of people by surprise this week.
It was very quick and very private.
Yeah. A lot of outpouring of support from people who, you know, I've seen a lot of tributes from former students, former kids that he coached, former colleagues, and also a lot of, you know, I don't think this is at all surprising, but a lot of bipartisan kind of camaraderie around just taking a moment to put politics aside at the Senate and stop and kind of you know, take a step back and remember, you know, what is kind of really important here. So there was a lot of that as well.
Yeah, I mean, the Senate is a very collegial place. It's one of the smallest political
24 people. Yeah,
right, one of the smallest political bodies, state political bodies in the country, and members develop a real affinity for one another, whatever the party. And they, in the Senate, you really have to work with the other party in order to get things done. That's a fact of life. And people found Scott McGillivray to be a very approachable, very accessible, very willing to compromise Democrat from the Republican side.
Well, our thoughts are with his family, and Scott McGillivray will be missed by everyone. The Senate, despite this tragedy, has been quite active. Let me turn to you first, Casey. A couple of big ticket items moving through the Senate. One that we've been talking about for a while and now seems to maybe be coming to pass is a needle exchange. And this has been a very somewhat controversial issue for a while.
Yeah, it's interesting. So this was up for debate as well last year. My understanding is that it did not move forward as people had hoped last year, and that, you know, there was some concerns that the way that it was written would have opened the door for a kind of decriminalization of heroin. Last year, we had police chiefs saying that because of the way the bill was constructed, it would allow people to deposit syringes that had trace amounts of heroin or illicit substances in them. And from a law enforcement perspective, some people raised concerns that that would in turn open the door for legalization. This time around, there seems to be more openness to the proposal that's on the table right now. This proposal would still allow police officers to prosecute people who are found with small amounts of heroin, but it exempts people who are enrolled in a needle exchange program or who are doing it through these designated places. And it would let community health centers, public health networks, AIDS service organizations, substance treatment organizations set up a place where people who are intravenous drug users can come and deposit their syringes and potentially get clean ones. And this, it's important to note that from a public health perspective, there's pretty wide consensus that this is a you know, important preventative measure for preventing the spread of diseases that could be spread by dirty needles or shared needles between people. So as New Hampshire continues to kind of grapple with its problems around substance abuse, particularly around heroin or other drugs that are injected, I think that that has maybe upped the urgency on this a little bit more as well.
And Kevin, I think we're the only state in New England that does not have a needle exchange program. Do you know?
Yeah, it sounds right. I think we are. The but there are lawmakers and remain who feel that this sends the wrong message, that in any respect allowing the you know, a needle exchange program in the midst of an opioid epidemic that New Hampshire has, it's not the right time to do this. But to be sure, this is a major step because certainly the House has been very supportive of a needle exchange program. And now you have the Senate having passed their own bill. So the chances for this actually getting to the governor are much higher than I think folks even thought they were going to be a month ago.
And Casey, this discussion of needle exchange and the opioid crisis is part of a kind of a larger discussion that now also includes, I think, five new state troopers and some additional millions of dollars for drug interdiction and funding. What else on this this topic?
Yeah, I think, as you said, there's the new funding that came forward recently for my understanding is that it's specifically to look at kind of the transport of drugs.
Yeah, I think this gets back to Governor Sununu's comments about the drugs coming up from Massachusetts.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to draw too firm a link between those two things because I personally can't say definitively that one was caused by the other. But the timing of it, I think the timing of the policy is relevant in light of the governor's statements about Lawrence being kind of a major site of drug trafficking for drugs that come up into New Hampshire. And then just a few weeks later, we see these proposals for increased patrols or enforcement of drug enforcement in that area. I do think it's interesting, though, just from a kind of big picture perspective, to step back and look at kind of the actions that the state is taking and where they are putting their resources or their attention relative to enforcement versus treatment mm-hmm. versus recovery or all of the other things that go into kind of addressing this problem. I've been working on some reporting with some colleagues at New Hampshire Public Radio around the opioid crisis or the addiction crisis in New Hampshire. And I have been talking with a lot of people who have experienced this either as family members or personally. And from a public perception, I can say that a lot of the people who are on the ground kind of looking at what the state is doing, there's some concern or some common themes that I've heard from people as far as getting the sense that at least what they're seeing publicly is, in their view, too much emphasis on the law enforcement side of things and not enough emphasis on building up the treatment capacity in the state.
And this has been a debate for a long time, Kevin. As long as I can remember with this issue, it's, you know, the law enforcement versus the sort of treatment and money for those kinds of resources.
Sure. And this governor certainly took a step towards supporting treatment.
The discourse definitely has changed.
In his budget, when he proposed increasing the money that goes to the so-called alcohol fund, which is for substance abuse and alcohol treatment. Interestingly enough, that same House Finance Subcommittee decided to zero that out, to essentially take out any dedicated amount in state law going to these treatment programs.
Casey, another issue taken up by the Senate, infrastructure and putting aside some money for cities and towns to work on infrastructure, sort of similar to something that Governor Sununu had proposed.
Yeah, this is my understanding is that this is less than what Sununu's budget called for. I think he called for about $84 million.
Yeah,
this proposal is about $37 million.
Yeah,
so about
that is
half,
a big difference.
Less than half. Yeah, but this basically kind of reiterates a similar proposal that we saw included in the governor's budget. This would pass about $37 million back down to towns and cities for road and bridge repairs. I'm not entirely clear on how the kind of decision making or prioritizing would work in terms of deciding how that gets doled out to those communities. But, you know, we've heard just generally for a while now the kind of calls from local communities for some help in this area. A lot of projects out there that are in need of completion. So I'm sure that, you know, cities would welcome kind of any help that they can get.
Kevin, do you think that is this going to be sufficient, or you think this is just the beginning of the infrastructure discussion?
Yeah, I think this is part of the horse trading, right? Is this governor really cares about this? The House budget writers know that. So we reduce that amount of money and see what the Senate does. And at the end of the day, it's probably going to be somewhere between the two.
You think closer to the high end or the low end? What's your hunch?
Well, I think it really, frankly, like I said, this all goes into the economic model. If you can tell me, you know, 3 months from now what the national and state economy are going to look like, are we going to continue to recover and it's going to be robust revenue estimates, then it's going to be the governor's number. If not, it's going to be closer to the House.
Well, infrastructure is certainly something that everyone is concerned about, particularly after we come out of the winter. We have a lot more to talk about here on The Exchange. We're going to talk a little bit about food stamps. We're going to talk a bit about voting reform. But we do need to take a short break, so please stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Diane Leigh Beck's latest novel about a woman lost in the woods explores the nature of love.
People expect it to be this great emotional high. Is love like that, or is it common? And if love is common, you know, what's so great about it?
I'm Peter Biello. The novel Breaking Wild is now out in paperback. Leigh Beck discusses her book on the bookshelf from NHPR. Find this podcast and all of NHPR's podcasts on iTunes or Google Play.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Dean Spiliotis, sitting in for Josh Rogers. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us with your questions or comments at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange at nhpr.org. I have two reporters joining me for the remainder of the hour, Kevin Landrigan, senior reporter at the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Casey McDermott, digital reporter here at NHPR. And we were talking about the legislation in the Senate. Before we go back to that, I want to mention that we received an email from a listener. Elizabeth writes on the Waterville Valley issue, doesn't the state own a skiing destination? Shouldn't the governor use the official Twitter account to promote that destination? So perhaps making a pitch for tweeting about state-owned ski resorts. So thanks for that email, Elizabeth. Let's go back to talking about the Senate. There's a lot of stuff going on. I want to talk next about food stamps. This is an issue, Kevin, where there's been a lot of debate about changing the program and eligibility and work requirements. It's been a pretty controversial issue.
It has. And a bill that initially has passed the state Senate would reduce the number of people who could receive food stamps. Right now, the state takes into account whether a person has a child in determining food stamp eligibility. This bill would stop that practice and require families that are above that federal poverty line to seek a waiver if they wish to continue to get benefits. This affects up to 17,000 people here in New Hampshire. The argument essentially is that this would weed out able-bodied people who are abusing these services and try and get them to go to work. Supporters say that you're talking about folks who are just barely – who may be working in low-wage jobs and are still eligible for food stamps, and it's unfair to deny them that. We're, again, still early on in this process. This bill has now gone to the Senate Finance Committee where it will also get some more review.
And then does it go back to the Senate?
It does.
Full Senate after that?
Correct.
Okay. And then potentially to the House.
Right.
Let's take a listen to what Senator Lou D'Alessandro had to say about cutting food stamps.
This has made the difference between life and death for a lot of people, survival. And I think we have something that served New Hampshire well for at least the last 50 years that I've been around this place.
That is Senator Lou D'Alessandro talking about potential cuts to the food stamp program. And Casey McDermott, this is something I know that has been discussed nationally. There's been a push to tighten or restrict food stamp eligibility, work requirements. What's your sense of the politics here?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is important to note the legislation has been revised a bit from its original form. But the original form of this bill was actually almost kind of a cookie cutter template from a national organization. I believe their name is the Foundation for Government Accountability. They've been pushing food stamp reform across the country, as you mentioned. But this, again, I think kind of gets back to a broader debate that we see on issues of healthcare, Medicaid, things like that with regard to the debate over, I think, you know, the extent to which people should be subject to, you know, income tests, work requirements, things like that. How many extra caveats should be placed on benefits that are being offered to people in need.
Yeah, and I think we're going to be following this for a while. I know this has been a bill of great importance to a variety of constituents, but it is controversial. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm here with Casey McDermott and Kevin Landrigan. And Casey, let me actually come back to you on something you've spent a lot of time studying and reporting on, this issue of voter reform and identification at the polls. Where are we on that legislation? I think there's been some movement on it.
Yeah. So this week, one of the kind of major pieces of legislation that has come forward this session, it's the official bill number is SB3. This has been referred to as kind of an omnibus bill that would include a number of different changes relative to the voter registration process in it. In short, it would enact kind of stricter verification requirements on people, particularly on those who are registering within 30 days of an election. The goal of the bill, as to kind of paraphrase its supporters, is to make sure that people who are here in New Hampshire for only kind of quote unquote temporary purposes are not voting in the elections. So some of the groups that they mention as being, you know, concerned are infiltrating the elections are people who are here to work on a campaign, people who are here only on a short-term basis. It's tough to pin down the extent to which that's an issue. And some people would even say that, you know, there's not – people who are opposing this bill would say that if someone's here on Election Day in New Hampshire and they're not casting a vote anywhere else, then that's they should also be treated as valid. And this is simply voter disenfranchisement. What we saw this week was a revised version of the bill that took out a particularly controversial provision.
This is about the police.
Yeah. We heard a lot of this at a public hearing about it a few weeks ago. There would have been a provision that explicitly said that people who did not show up to the polls on Election Day with the proper types of verification may be subject to checks from law enforcement at the address that they provided during routine police patrols. The legislation was opposed by the New Hampshire Chiefs of Police Association, raised a lot of concerns from the New Hampshire Municipal Association, among others. I'm unclear on where they stand on the revised version of the bill. The revised version includes so it took out that section, but still includes a reference to election officials may send themselves or agents out. And some opponents of the bill have said that, oh, by saying agents, then you're still leaving open
the
possibility.
What do you mean by an agent, right?
The sponsor of the bill told, I believe, WMUR that that was not the intent. The intent of including that particular phrase was to allow for election investigators or people with who are affiliated with the Attorney General's office, things like that.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, my guess is that whatever comes out of this, it'll probably go to the courts at some point in the civil rights argument.
Also important to note that we're talking about the police provision, but even with the removal of that, there were a number of other concerns that were raised from voting rights groups in particular. And I would be very surprised if this does not get challenged in some way if it comes to pass.
And Kevin, I want to shift gears in the time we have left and talk a little bit about some general we'll obviously be following that as it develops, but I want to shift attention and talk a little bit about some general political news. We have our congressional delegation down in Washington, the House facing a vote on health care, the Senate, the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. Let's listen a little bit to Maggie Hassan talking about her criteria for voting in favor or not of nominee Gorsuch.
What's important with any judicial nominee is that they have the legal expertise and experience and the character to serve on the court. But it's also really important that they understand and are committed to protecting the civil rights of all Americans. And that's what I'll be looking for during his hearing process, to see if he will commit to that.
That is Senator Maggie Hassan talking about her process for deciding whether or not to support Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. We have heard from New York Senator Chuck Schumer, the minority leader in the Senate, that they are going to try to filibuster. Kevin, we also know there was a sort of unannounced meeting with Governor Sununu and Senator Hassan. What, if anything, do you take from Hassan's comments there?
Well, I think their code for I'm probably going to vote against his nomination, particularly if the decision of the Senate Democratic leadership is we're going to filibuster this. When she talks about wanting assurances on civil rights issues, this nominee is not going to commit that he's pro-choice on abortion. He's not going to commit that I'm going to support LGBT rights whenever they come before this court. We've seen him, as we have seen with the past litany of nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court before a U.S. Senate confirmation committee, to decline to comment on any public policy matter in advance of.
It's really been that way since the Bork hearings, and
absolutely,
and I've watched a lot of these, and I will say that Judge Gorsuch is very careful when he talks about these.
He's been quite skillful during these hearings in terms of pairing Senate Democratic questions and also getting a lot of compliments from Senate Democrats on the committee for his debate skills, if you will.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Let's check in with our March fund drive. So, Casey, I'm interested in your thoughts as well on either the health care bill in the House, which I know I'm assuming that the Democratic members of the House will vote against here from New Hampshire, but also your thoughts on the Senate confirmation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. Just one, you know, I'm just endlessly fascinated by the dynamic that's been set up here, where for the last year before the election, we had then Governor Hassan pressing then Senator Kelly Ayotte over this Supreme Court issue.
Who is now shepherding?
Who is now
shepherding the nomination?
The nominee through the confirmation process. And it's just been kind of funny to me that when I do tune in or see clips from the Gorsuch hearing, you know, there's former Senator Ayotte sitting just
right
over his shoulder.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's, you know, I think what Kevin said is right. I think I, for one, I don't want to make a prediction either way, but I would be surprised if Senator Hassan does vote for Gorsuch, just given the dynamics that are in play and the level of opposition and pressure that Democratic senators are facing from their constituents right now.
Kevin.
You know, what's interesting about the health care vote in the U.S. House, as we saw this week, Governor Chris Sununu's quote, concerns about mandates certainly played out on Capitol Hill. These House Freedom Caucus members were echoing some of the same opposition or concerns, and that's what led to House Speaker Paul Ryan on Thursday pulling the bill off the floor, that these conservative members believe this is too much Obamacare light, that it's not enough of a fundamental overhaul of the health care system. There's not enough free market provisions in here. And certainly Governor Sununu remains very concerned that whatever comes out of this legislation helps the state combat the opioid crisis as well.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch him kind of position sort of develop on Medicaid expansion. We like to end the show asking our reporters a little bit about what they're going to be working on next week. Casey, let me start with you.
I think I'm going to still be keeping an eye on just kind of how this this selfie complaint develops, whether it manifests itself into anything larger than what it initially is. I mentioned that we're doing a lot of reporting, as we have been, around the opioid crisis. We're going to have a new project launching soon that looks at that more in depth. And I'm working on a section of that that will look particularly, like I said, at people who have been personally affected by that. So we'll be focusing on those stories.
Yeah, Kevin, real quick.
Yeah, we're going to look at next week, certainly. There'll be a memorial service this weekend for Scott McGilvery. So we're going to be reporting pretty aggressively on what this special election is going to look like. Also, look at the last time there was a vacancy by death in the state Senate. The liberal lion, former Senate President Junie Blaisdell, 20 years ago, passed away. That touched off quite an upheaval and power struggle, if you will. And we'll see what happens with this vacancy.
Mm-hmm. And I want to remind our listeners that you can tune in and listen to Governor Sununu next Tuesday, March 28th. He'll be a guest right here on The Exchange. We are out of time. I'd like to thank my guest for joining us. Kevin, it's great to see you.
Same here, Dean.
And Casey, it's always great to talk on the Roundup with you.
Thank you.
And remember, the conversation always continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Josh Rogers.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.